Young. I'm Allison Rose-Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, media, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between the well-being of our families, our communities, our society, and the planet Earth. Each week on the show, we talk about all the different interconnected facets of our world and how they affect our lives today and the lives of future generations. Today, I'm honored to have on the show Jeff Weaver, who is the right-hand person of Senator Bernie Sanders. Jeff Weaver was his campaign manager for the 2016 presidential election, as well as president of Our Revolution, a nonprofit founded by Sanders. Jeff Weaver graduated from the University of Vermont and Georgetown University Law School, and he's currently senior political advisor to Senator Sanders, as well as the author of a new book, which we'll be discussing today on Connect the Dots. The book is called How Bernie Won, Inside the Revolution That's Taking Back Our Country and Where We Go From Here. Very important questions. Honored and pleased to welcome to Connect the Dots, Jeff Weaver.
Hey, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's really been a great read to read your hot off the press's new book, How Bernie Won, because it revisits a lot of our history, offering a backstage look and deeper insight into many things that happened and that occurred and that we knew or did not know, or some people knew or did not know in terms of
going
on. And I think that's it's really great to revisit that from kind of balanced political sense, as opposed to the way there's often been sort of a lot of blame and vituperation passed around. So
right.
I think it's very important and helpful in creating a sort of foundation for moving forward constructively. So highly recommended and really happy about that. One of the biggest dilemmas of our time really is front and center in your book, which is the dilemma of the history of losses and kind of repositioning of the Democratic Party, and at the same time the need to work with that party in perhaps coalition with other parties like the Democratic Socialists of America, which recently had a candidate, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, elected on the Democratic Party line, while also, in order to defeat the agenda of Donald Trump and those whom he represents and who are funding him. And that's really sort of a central puzzle of our time. What do you regard as the lessons learned about that from the 2016 campaign and what we have seen since the 2017 election for going forward into the 2018 midterms and into 2020, the upcoming, the future presidential election?
Right. Well, it's obviously that question could take us 4 hours to discuss or 5 hours or longer. And there are a lot of bright people in this country trying to figure that puzzle out. But, I was excited about being on this show because of the, what you talked about is the interconnectedness of things, which I think is extremely important to keep in mind. And, the book is not just a rehash of 2016, although there are some, it obviously deals with that race, but also deals with that race in the context of the modern history of the Democratic Party. And how we've gotten so off track since the administration of Bill Clinton in the 90s, and how the party has really been dismantled in the sense that it has lost faith with so many people in this country of all races who no longer view the Democratic Party as a vehicle for change. And one of the things that we have got to do as a foundational issue is to get the Democratic Party back on its modern historical trajectory, to a party that stands for greater equality, greater inclusion, and greater opportunity for all people. We sort of lost our way. And in many ways, the 2016 race was an expression by the grassroots of the Democratic Party and by allied independent voters and other voters who were saying, look, we reject this move to the right, this corporatist move by the party, and we want our party back. We want this to be the party that can make social and economic change in this country so that all people have an opportunity and not just the very wealthy and powerful and connected. Some of the lessons I think we learned from the 2016 race, and, you know, this is just a few of them, but certainly we saw in the general election the extent to which working class voters of all races have sort of walked away. I think Dan Jones, who many people will know as a CNN commentator and author, put it well when, you know, he said that for many white voters, Trump was, you know, basically disgusting but not disqualified. And for many black voters, he was disgusting and disqualified. And so, you know, white voters would voted for him, and then many black voters just stayed home. And that was certainly what we saw anecdotally from on our end during the general election of the campaign. And so what we have got to do, in my view, is we have got to put forward a list of what I call common aspirations. That is, you know, what families want for themselves and their children and their parents. And when you poll people, what's fascinating about this is when you poll people, regardless of where they, their geography, their race, their generation, you know, what people want is pretty similar in terms of having economic security, in terms of being able to live in dignity, social dignity, enable, in order for their kids to have good schools and opportunities going forward, and people not being poor in their retirement. So we have to, you know, lay out an agenda for how we're going to achieve those things. That's issue number one. And number two, at the same time, we have to understand, because we all are interconnected, that the challenges facing people in different communities is different. So many communities in this country are facing the issue of over-policing and police violence. Other communities are facing bad schools. Other communities are facing deindustrialization. And, you know, some communities may be facing some or all of these in combination and a host of other barriers. And so we have got to articulate how we are going to deal with these specific barriers that exist in each community to deal with the fact that they're not reaching these common aspirations. And I think when we frame it in that context, that we are trying to lift all communities, that we're trying to bring all people up, while we recognize that the challenges faced in one community may not be the same as the other, I think that you will get to a place where people will not be upset that you're helping people in one community, even if it's not directly helping them, because they understand that this is part of a broader program to create a better life for everybody in the country. And I think too often because we don't articulate a set of bold principles as our common set of common aspirations, that the Republicans then are able to drive wedges between communities and create the false narrative that by helping one community, you're disadvantaging somebody else. And they, you know, they rely on that kind of division and hatred and anger. And we as progressives have got to show them that there is, in fact, another way.
You know, this is very true. I have covered the Trans-Pacific Partnership and trade agreements extensively and early on. And, you know, I think there was a great deal of underestimation of the disenchantment with NAFTA and these kinds of trade deals and the terrible price paid by communities in the Rust Belt. And at one point during the campaign, someone said to me, oh, you're totally wrong in saying that, you know, these substantial swaths of the Midwest are concerned about the TPP and these trade agreements. Because they don't have time to read that fine print. And, of course, the response is they lived it. They don't need to, you know, it's really the coastal populations who were maybe intellectually opposed, but not really fully immersed in all the ramifications. And I think that exemplifies, you know, a loss in extending the net of compassion to communities different than one's own. Well, the other thing that comes to mind is in the book you detail quite extensively the struggle behind the scenes, and some of it was public at the time, too, in creating the Democratic Party platform in 2016, something which Senator Sanders and allies had a voice in, as well as delegates in, thanks to your good work and you know, kind of hard fight, as well as the votes of many people. And even there, one can see that, you know, there were some wins, and some have called it the most progressive platform in party history. But also, there were a lot of sticking points. And these really arose from other agendas and alliances of the Democratic Party. Has that changed? Have those alliances changed? Have those agendas changed? Because they seem to, you know, sort of dictate the kind of lip service and loss of credibility, you know, and kind of speaking out of one's mouth in different directions and not really so that the word, you know, of Democratic politicians cannot so easily be trusted and, you know, kind of reluctance or inability to deliver to these different communities, as you described, beyond lip service. Has that changed? Is it, you know, did the 2016 loss change it? What are you seeing, if anything, operative within the Democratic Party right now on its ability to let go of these agendas and really stand with people who deliver some of the things that the public is asking for?
Well, you know, my view, and I have interaction. I was on what was called the Unity Reform Commission, which was a commission that was created out of the Democratic National Convention in order to help reform the party and to reform the electoral process to make it more democratic and transparent, both the party and the process. And that was a commission that was had appointees by Senator Sanders, had appointees by Secretary Clinton, and had appointees by the DNC. And the Sanders delegates were the minority of representation on the committee. And yet the committee itself passed pretty sweeping recommendations unanimously in the end. And I think it just demonstrates the extent to which there is a lot of soul searching going on now in the Democratic Party. I have to tell you that there are, and I think it's a minority, frankly, of entrenched folks. Some of the donor class, some of the people who I describe as being involved in dilettante politics, you know, they like to say they're high up in the DNC because it's a social badge, and they talk about it at cocktail parties. You know, those people, they'll never get it. And, you know, over time, hopefully those people will be pushed out of any kind of leadership in the party. We need to make this a grassroots party that represents middle-income and working people across this country. So I do think that there are some elements of the party who understand what's going on. You know, for instance, the party chair, Tom Perez, has been very, very active and acted in completely good faith and is pushing very hard to eliminate the role of superdelegates in the nominating process. Now, folks will remember that there are a number of folks, over 700, who are DNC members or various elected officials who all get a vote for president at the Democratic National Convention. And in a two-person race, if someone can basically lock up those superdelegates, they already have 30% of the votes they need to win the nomination. So it puts insurgent candidates, whether it be Bernie Sanders or anybody else for that matter, at a marked disadvantage, because that means you have to win every state by 30% in order to have a chance at winning the nomination. Well, and their delegate totals equal the delegate totals of 25 states in the District of Columbia combined. So they have enormous power, and to reduce or eliminate their power would greatly democratize the process by which Democrats pick their nominee. And Tom Perez has been really a warrior on this, and I think has taken a lot of flack from some folks inside the party, but he's to be congratulated for doing that, for standing up for what is right. You know, there are other issues where we'll disagree, but certainly on that one, there's an example of you know, somebody who ran against Keith Ellison, who I think everybody acknowledges was the candidate of the progressive wing. Tom Perez narrowly won, but has done what he said he would do in terms of superdelegates. So I applaud him on that, and I use that as an example of, you know, one place where top party people are beginning to move. And I think, you know, as we see more and more electoral success by progressives, you mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Obviously a tremendous victory for progressive politics in America. But, you know, on that same night, Ben Jealous was the winner of the Democratic primary for governor of Maryland. That he was in fifth place when he started, and a strong progressive who was an active surrogate for Bernie on the campaign in 2016, who won in Maryland is to be the governor of Maryland. Stacey Abrams running an unabashedly progressive campaign in Georgia. We're also seeing, you know, Andrew Gillum is running in Florida and has new energy in his campaign. I think some people counted him out, but it looks like he's a bit resurgent right now, and we're seeing at the local level too. I mean, I was we were active in the race of Emily Serrato, who was a state legislative candidate in Colorado who won quite handily. So this is going on, and that's just a few examples. I mean, we saw what happened in Virginia during the race in Virginia for the House of Delegates. A number of progressives there who the local party had written off came through and won. Lee Carter in Manassas, Virginia, a relatively conservative exurb of Washington, D.C., who ran as an unabashed Democratic Socialist, beat the Republican whip of the House of Delegates in Virginia. So we're seeing these kinds of victories all over the country. And as that happens, people inside the party who have an interest in winning, because it is a political party that wants to win elections, they begin to say, wow, this is, we were wrong. You do not have to be a centrist, corporate centrist to win, even in conservative areas. That, in fact, voters want bold, progressive leadership. And we saw that in 2016. Bernie Sanders won all, I'm not going to say all, but almost all the rural counties in the country. And he was winning with conservative, quote-unquote, conservative and moderate Democrats, beating Secretary Clinton. So, if establishment Democrats can't win rural Democrats, how do they think they're going to win rural independents or rural Republicans? So I think there were a lot of lessons out of 2016. Some are being heeded and some are not.
Hmm. And what role is our revolution or other, is it merely that, and it's not merely, it's actually a big deal, that people who are organizers or who were inspired or who were, onlooking and then became activated through watching the 2016 campaign are stepping up to serve the voice of the people and what people are really demanding and need in this time. Is it merely that, or is there also some kind of, advice or other support that is still kind of proceeding to unroll and help people, get elected and find their voice and have the courage to participate? Like, is that ongoing? What's going on in that capacity?
Right. So, I get a lot of grief from some folks in the neoliberal circles about the title of the book, How Bernie Won. But, this is one of the ways in which Bernie did win, which is he inspired a lot of people to run. A lot of people who either worked on our campaign or volunteered on our campaign, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being one of them, showing that, in fact, you can take on the establishment, you can represent working people, you can represent marginalized communities, and you can win. So I think that was an important part of what came out of 2016, was this sense that, yes, you can run and, yes, you can be successful. Our revolution, which I was the president of for a year, and which is now headed by my good friend, Senator Nina Turner, who's doing a great job there. They provide support for candidates in a number of ways. We quite effectively in 2016 used what is called distributed organizing, where you have volunteers who may not live in a state or locality where an election is going on, but who can participate in helping to elect that candidate by, for instance, calling voters or doing other things remotely. Our revolution does that kind of work very effectively. There in Somerville, Massachusetts, there was a city council election where a whole slate of, our Rev endorsed candidates, and every single one of them won and took over the city council. So they've been very successful, and but they're not alone. There are other groups as well, groups that have been around longer, DFA, Move On, and other new groups, Indivisible and Swing Leftists. So there's a whole host of groups out there that are PCCC, a whole set of groups that are out there helping candidates with some of the nuts and bolts of campaigning as well. And look, this is critically important because, there is more to running for office than just sort of putting your name out there and knocking on doors. There is a lot of technical skills that campaigns need that our revolution and others are helping to provide so that folks learn how to effectively do field work and reach out to voters. Because in the end of the day, look, it's all about presenting a bold message from an authentic messenger and then communicating that to voters and making sure the voters who respond to that come out and vote. I mean, that's in the barest sense what an election is. And these groups, our revolution included, is helping to do that. And our revolution success rate has been quite high. I mean, it's only a couple of years old, and I think the last statistic I saw that over 40% of its candidates were winning. So that's that's pretty substantial. And you know, the other thing is, you know, and some of those groups also help with messaging. I mean, I saw a statistic recently that half of the candidates running for the Congress as a Democrat who raised $1,000 or more had Medicare for All in their literature. And that, you know, that's something that 4 years ago, it would have been 3% or 2%. So that's another way in which Bernie won, is that he has been able to broaden the scope of what's acceptable in terms of policy remedies to some of the very pressing problems we face. So, you know, I'm very proud of the work that our revolution is doing now and did when I was there, and as well as all these other groups that are out there, you know, trying to create a more progressive and better America.
Yeah, it's really, truly inspiring. I mean, one of the things that has been happening is that support for single payer has been, you know, which was ruled out and regarded as an impossibility for some particular reason by the Democratic Party, has been creeping up through all of this in terms of popular support. And so, you know, it's approaching a point, and I don't know if we've currently crossed it or not, where, you know, so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and single payer are, you know, approaching equality in terms of their popularity with the country, you know. So that's pretty impressive right there. Of course, it makes sense. Yet, you know, there's still those who, you know, there's this kind of messaging or belief, you know, that that Democrats or liberals, progressives should stick to the tried and true. For example, I recently was at a town hall in which Senator Ed Markey was speaking and asked if there was any potential, for example, if Bernie Sanders were to run in 2020, for the Democratic establishment to break ranks and endorse him. And Senator Markey brought up the fact that he was a champion of the Affordable Care Act, as if, you know, that was kind of an enormous reason why he personally could not do so. So, you know, it's, I mean, there's, and so to me, that was also just a, you know, and, you know, Senator Markey is liberal on a whole range of different issues. And yet when it came to this one, he seemed to, you know, have a very strong anti-single payer predisposition. And, you know, it just led me to wonder, you know, about the wisdom, and maybe this is just what you were speaking to when you said there were certain figures who were quite entrenched and others who might be movable. But, you know, the conventional wisdom that you have to stick with certain long-established planks, that a shift would be, you know, a big turnoff, that it's not possible. And here it was coming up. I mean, I wasn't asking a healthcare question, but that's right. What he brought up. Would love to hear your comments on that and reflections on that.
Yeah, so look, there's a lot of conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C., and, you know, the view, they have a very linear view of politics, and their view is that there are Democrats on the left, Republicans on the right, and all of these so-called moderate independents in the middle. Well, you know, that was the model that was used in the 90s, and it happens just not to be true, and it's increasingly not true. For one reason being that young people are overwhelmingly registering as independent voters. They overwhelmingly lean left. And so when you look at the pool of independent voters in this country, and in fact, it is not a centrist group of voters. It is increasingly a left group of voters. And, you know, that's a mistake that some Democrats make at their own peril because, you know, for instance, in New York State, where we keep independent voters from voting in Democratic primaries, you know, we are essentially excluding young people who are the future of the party. And the truth of the matter is some Pew research I saw shows that the demographic group with the highest percentage of Democratic leaning independents in it is millennial African Americans. So it seems wrong to me to try to exclude young African Americans from the Democratic Party, you know, process. That seems crazy to me. On the terms of single payer, you know, I think some folks sort of just don't get how you make change in this country in a democratic process. You know, we had FDR who brought in Social Security, you know, made a number of reforms to labor laws and the 8-hour work week and so on and so forth, 8-hour work day. And then, you know, subsequent presidents would make improvements on those things or enact other things. Well, that's not a repudiation of what went on before, but that's building upon what went on before. Barack Obama, to his credit, when he became president, despite the fact that he was facing the imminent collapse of the world financial system due to the lax regulation of the Bush administration and, frankly, some of the deregulation that went on under Bill Clinton, decided that he was going to, you know, tackle what was then considered the third rail of politics, dealing with health care. And, they, you know, they eventually came up with the Affordable Care Act. Well, you know, that was a deal that was made and a program that was passed in a particular historical moment. And the truth of the matter is that until the very end of that process, until a couple of, frankly, conservative Democrats, Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson, both senators at the time, torpedoed key aspects of it, including the public option and expanding Medicare to younger participants, which would have made the current program much, much better than it is now. You know, they passed that in that environment with a lot of opposition from, obviously, the insurance industry and from, again, some conservative elements of their own party. And so they created the Affordable Care Act. Because we would eventually move to single payer, it's not a repudiation of the Affordable Care Act or the great work that Barack Obama and his team did in pushing health care forward, but is, you know, is building on that. Each generation builds on the work of the past generation and hopefully moves us closer and closer to the ideal of the kind of society we want. Not everything is achievable in a given historical moment. And I think folks get wedded to a particular set of words in a statute rather than understanding that what we're trying to do always, the North Star of this is, are we making the lives of working people better? And are we going to be able in the future to make it even better than we're making it now? That's always the goal. And so, you know, one can applaud Barack Obama and his administration for the Affordable Care Act, which I do, brought health insurance to millions and millions, tens and tens of millions of people. You know, Bernie Sanders was the chief defender of the Affordable Care Act when Trump was elected and tried to destroy it. It was Bernie Sanders, not Ed Markey or not other establishment figures, who were organizing rallies all around the country. I think Bernie ultimately organized over 100 rallies across the country, many of them simulcast. Many Democratic senators and House members were at those rallies, frankly. It was Bernie Sanders who was the point person for defending the Affordable Care Act, and Donald Trump lost on that one. And that was one of his first assaults out of the gate on the, you know, the vital social safety net in this country. So, you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can protect the advancements we've made while we still try to push the ball forward. And that's what Bernie Sanders does. And that's what I think progressives have to do as well.
That's a great formulation of it. It makes a lot of sense. You know, since we were also talking about New York and the denial of, you know, for independents, the right to vote in a Democratic primary. And we recently, you know, had a gathering in New York, which basically determined, you know, the Democratic primary candidate without a public vote, putting Governor Cuomo back as the candidate in, you know, in a way that kind of left the public and voting out of the picture. We now have Cynthia Nixon, who is a kind of rallying point for progressives. You know, what are the options in a state like New York where, you know, the party has, in effect, captured that important decision and not allowed the public to participate? Now the Democratic line will have Governor Cuomo on it. As someone who was one of the very first reporters on fracking and the TPP and the pipeline problems in New York State, you know, we definitely had an important win with a lot of reporting and pressuring and letter writing and campaigns to stop actual fracking in New York. And yet, you know, right, the pipelines and all the rest of it continues. So we want to thank Governor Cuomo for that. And yet, you know, in these times, there could be recapitulation to, you know, with pressure from the gas and oil industry, you know, now being represented at the national level. You know, it's really important to advance the progressive. What are the options for someone like Cynthia Nixon or, you know, for others in states where the Democratic line is not really open and available to all comers?
Yeah, well, this is a problem, and this was, you know, part of the recommendations of this Unity Reform Commission that I mentioned earlier. One of the, like, New York is, I have to tell you, is one of the worst in the country. You know, we talk about voter suppression in places like in red states, you know, where they have onerous voter ID laws, or they do voter roll purges, or they do these different things. But I have to tell you that New York State has one of the lowest voter turnouts in the country, which is embarrassing for a bright blue state like New York, which you would think would have one of the highest voter turnouts in the country. And a lot of it has to do with the sort of culture of voting in New York, which has to do with these closed primaries. Now, the truth of the matter is that it doesn't require a statutory change. The Democratic Party could, state committee could vote to have independent or non-aligned voters participate in its primaries and caucuses like most states do. Frankly, a majority of states have open primaries for independent voters. They could do that, and the state of New York, in its testimony before the Unity Reform Commission, said, well, of course, if they told us that, we would have to oblige, because, you know, it's their party and they get to determine the rules for who gets to participate in it. But if you look at New York, you know, the number of young people who were shut out, and you look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's race, can you imagine how many young people in her district were frozen out? And this is why it's particularly bad in New York. Most states have a voter registration deadline. In some states, it's same day registration. Some days it's 30 days out. There's some other deadline. And obviously, I think most progressives support same day registration. And then states also have party switch deadlines. Those states that have party registration have party switch deadlines. And by the way, not every state has party registration. Vermont doesn't. Virginia doesn't. A host of states don't have party registration. But those states that do typically have deadlines also for switching your party affiliation. And those are, generally speaking, aligned with the voter registration deadline. So in New York State, the voter registration deadline is 30 days before the election, but the party switch deadline is in the prior year. So if you wanted to vote in this federal primary that just happened in New York, you had to have switched from independent to Democrat last fall. And the gubernatorial primary is coming up, you know, after that. The deadline was the same. You had to have switched your party registration last fall. So this creates the effect of locking people out of the Democratic primary, independent voters, primarily young voters, voters of color, for no reason other than that party bosses want to be able to control the universe of voters at a particular time and advantage certain candidates. Same in New York. This year they split the primary, so the federal primaries were on one day, and the state primaries are on a different day. Well, I was actually talking with a high-level DNC official just last week who said to me, well, the only reason to do that is to suppress the vote by creating multiple primaries. You know, and then we had in 2016, obviously, all the voting rolls, which were messed up in various parts of the state, which led the Justice Department to investigate New York's handling of elections. All this is to say that New York's electoral system is broken very badly. It causes people not to participate just as effectively as Republican voter suppression campaigns in other states. And this is this is ultimately going to have to be the role of people in New York to let the Democratic Party know that they no longer want to live with this, and I'll use this word rigged, which gets thrown around a lot, but in this case it is, this rigged electoral structure in New York, which is frustrating the will of the voters of New York, both Democrats and democratically aligned independents. So it is very embarrassing that a great state like New York, and I like New York very much, has such low voter turnout, and it's not happening by accident. It's just not that people don't care. It is that there are structural impediments to people participating, and it is ultimately going to harm the Democratic Party in New York, frankly.
Well, the show that I did last week was with Westchester County, an affluent county north of New York City, organizers and activists and who are residents there, really sharing for a full hour the lockdown in trying to get progressive voices heard. And almost it sounded like a combination of fear and money and a very strong predisposition to predetermine everything going on in that county, leaving very few points of entree. So, you know, where are the leverage points for New York State residents who don't like this setup to intervene? Is Cynthia Nixon's, you know, candidacy a leverage point? What would be the best strategy for somebody who's been shut out that way and yet is a popular figure who is representing the progressive voice in the state?
Right. Well, I think this is you know, Bernie always likes to say change comes from the bottom, not from the top. And, you know, the truth of the matter is what's going to happen is that you're going to have a grassroots pressure, and that, you know, and what form that takes, whether that's rallies in front of the Democratic Party headquarters or other places, to let the Democratic Party know that they can no longer in New York State engage in voter suppression, that this is not acceptable. It is a fundamental principle of not only progressive politics, but the Democratic Party. And you talk about the party platform. The party platform is full of references to how we have to get more people voting, how we have to end state-sanctioned voter suppression. But it's going on in New York State, and we have to be as vocal about it going on in New York State as we are about it going on in red states, because it is a fundamental, a very fundamental assault on our principles as Democrats and as progressives, that we want the voice of the people to be heard, and that the people should be the ones who are picking the leaders and not just party insiders.
Yes, that's really true, without a doubt. You know, and I think that's an inspiration for more organizing around this, now that we see, you know, through Ocasio-Cortez's victory and other signs, you know, that we can, when people organize and sort of flex that muscle, we have very positive results. Another question, which is kind of a little bit stepping back into the past, but I think it's an important one. In the book, you talk about frequently, in fact, are quoting information about some of the behind-the-scenes operations of the Democratic National Committee during the 2016 election. And a lot of the source of the information that you quote, including, you know, your discussion of the Pied Piper strategy, which was that apparently the Clintons supported a kind of Republican Party outlier like Donald Trump as being more beatable, which, of course, I mean, I guess it would have to be one of the biggest gaffes in insight, political insight, you know, ever heard of at this point in time. But your source for that is the WikiLeaks. And at the time, which, you know, were releases by Julian Assange, at the time, I was also assiduously reading them. There was a lot of, you know, very important information in them. And I would say since that time, you know, obviously you looked at them very thoroughly, because what you found there reflected stuff that you believed to be happening and saw evidence for, but did not really have the concrete proof that would come from an email in which instructions were passed or different parties were conferring about something and making decisions, you know, which were present in the emails. And so at that time, as a journalist myself, I regarded that as being, you know, an unconventional, but a important and valuable source of information, especially considering the fact that the media at large was giving an enormous amount of attention to Donald Trump and, as you put it, putting Bernie Sanders in the shade. And, you know, this is apart from the independent media in which I report. So, but nowadays, looking at WikiLeaks, you know, several years as we now are down the line, you know, there's a whole kind of bad jacket on WikiLeaks, a lack of understanding about the role of that kind of outlier journalism. And in fact, in the public mind today, WikiLeaks has somehow become identified entirely with Putin, something that you don't mention explicitly in how Bernie won, but which, you know, I think it's kind of important to kind of represent the bigger picture a little bit about that kind of journalism and what we've learned from it, as opposed to, you know, just looking to the concept that maybe, you know, this Putin is the one who, you know, the Putin name has been kind of used as to you know, to kind of put a bad jacket on the whole enterprise. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, so I do cite to WikiLeaks a number of points in the book. I mean, let me say this up front. I certainly do not condone, you know, the hacking of anybody's emails and other conduct that clearly went on, whether it's the DNC's emails or John Podesta's emails or anybody else. So I don't condone that. Now, on the other hand, once the material is out, you know, what do you, you know, when you are trying to tell the story of what happened and the information is available, you know, then, you know, this is obviously the topic of some conversation in journalistic circles. You know, do you avail yourself of information that is sort of ill-gotten? That's, you know, and I did, frankly, because I thought that there was some valuable information there in terms of, you know, documenting what we were seeing, but which, you know, others, you know, were denying, and for which there was at that time not a lot of independent verification. I will say that, you know, Donna Brazile, and a rather courageous move, which brought a tremendous amount of scorn on her from establishment circles, in her book, exposed the fact that there was this contract between the DNC, which we certainly did not know, from the summer of 2015, which effectively gave the Clinton campaign control of the DNC during the primary process. So that was not something we knew before Donna Brazile's book. And the fact that, you know, she bravely brought that forward, I think, just provides additional corroboration of the fact that, you know, the DNC was acting on behalf of the Clinton campaign largely throughout the process.
So, you know, quite apart from WikiLeaks, you're saying. You don't take a position on the, you know, the current initiatives, the Mueller investigation, the role of Putin or any of that in the election results. You know, do you have any comment on that?
Well, look, I would say a few things. I obviously think Comey's back and forth was created a tremendous amount of chaos in the election. It is clear to me that there were foreign elements who were trying to create chaos during the election process in an attempt to destabilize the sort of political institutions in this country. I don't think there's any dispute about that. I think Mr. Mueller's investigation should be conducted openly and fairly. And if there are problems there, people who are responsible should face the penalties for what they did. I'm certainly supportive of that. You know, at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, why was the election so close to begin with that these things could tip the scale in that direction? That to me is a fundamental question. Why is it that Donald Trump, a candidate like Donald Trump, which is, you know, leading this country increasingly toward authoritarianism, whose administration thrives on xenophobia, bigotry, hatred, and division, why a candidate like that is even in a position to win the first of all the Republican nomination, and then secondly, to even be competitive in a general election? Why was Secretary Clinton not 20 points ahead? And there are a lot of reasons for that, but those are that's, I think, the much more fundamental question. If we, as progressives, are going to stem the rightward movement of you know, the organs of government, if we're going to stop an administration that increasingly uses fascist-like rhetoric, we have got to understand why it is that a person like that was even viable in the environment in 2016, and why that person may be viable in 2020. I think that's fundamental. And if we only focus on Comey and the Russians and that kind of thing, which I think we should focus on, but if we only focus on those things, I think we will miss a larger and more fundamental question. And one of those, as you mentioned already, is the role that the media played in the creation of Donald Trump. I mean, my view is that he is entirely a creation of the media. And in fact, in my book, I document, I think, quite well that top media people were rooting for Donald Trump's, you know, next outrageous statement, and how they covered his rallies from beginning to end. And, you know, he ultimately, at the end of the day, received billions of dollars in free media. And they created him. And then I think many of them at the end tried to kill him. But, you know, sometimes the Frankenstein monster cannot be defeated so easily. And so, you know, I put a lot of blame on the media and particularly the 24-hour cable news stations, for, in fact, creating a Donald Trump and the disastrous policies that he has implemented?
I was really gratified as someone who's been in the media for several decades and watched this terrible devolution. And part of that devolution, as you cite in how Bernie won, is they're doing it for ratings. They make money when people tune into him, regardless of what he's saying and how he's influencing people and changing it, really devolving the entire public understanding and public conversation. Do you think part of that is just all about ratings, or do you think that the corporate ownership of media may be agenda driven in certain kinds of ways? Like, we know that Comcast, for example, owns MSNBC. There are other entities that own other of the media conglomerates, thanks to the Telecommunications Act that Bill Clinton signed. We now have these media monopolies. Are there ways that, beyond ratings, that this conglomeration of influence is fundamentally anti-progressive in some way?
Right. Well, let me say this. I mean, I think it is always a concern when, the major sources of one's news are controlled by a corporate entity whose, interests may not align with the common interest. Folks remember that GE owned, which was a big weapons maker, was a longtime owner of NBC. And there was always concern that, when the business on one side of the house was affecting the business on the other side. That being said, certainly the media folks that I interact with all the time, and by that I mean reporters and TV hosts and what have you, are pretty universally appalled by Trump on a very deeply personal level. I do think when you talk about corporate ownership, I mean, corporate ownership means, we all know what the chief motivation of corporations is, which is money, and ratings equal money. And I think the cable news networks have benefited handsomely from Trump's presidency in terms of viewership. And I think that's true of all the media outlets. The political departments at all of the media outlets are full of people. In a normal presidential election cycle, after the presidential election is over, many folks who were covering the politics of the presidential election, either have to go into different parts of the media or what have you, because the amount of political reporting is much less. But the political reporting departments at all the media are huge, and there's a tremendous amount of money being made. And to me, that seems to be the primary motivator. I mean, unlike other than Fox, of course, which is a full-on mouthpiece for the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's an interesting and important insight. When I asked a question of Senator Markey at this recent town hall meeting, my current question to him was given that Trump is not only worse, which was the kind of, that was a campaign slogan used by the Democratic Party, but he's even worse than worse. I mean, he's gotten worse. Everything he continues to do is worse. And we're on a worse to worse to worst pathway. Given that, without sort of shutting down the democratic process, but since Trump is worse, and that was, the prime argument among people who were not enthusiastic about voting in a neoliberal candidate like Hillary Clinton, but that was the sort of mission at the time to keep Trump from office. And now he's here, and, we can see it's far worse than any of us imagined. Given that, doesn't that give us some kind of responsibility not to go window shopping for different possible candidates for the highest office in 2020, but to unite sooner rather than later around the most trusted figure, the most popular figure who has emerged?
Okay, well, I can only guess who that is. I don't want to spoil the ending of the book for people, but the last three words of the book are "Run, Bernie, run," because I do think that I think at this historical moment, it is all about historical moments, that Bernie Sanders would be the strongest candidate against Trump and the one most likely to bring us to victory. not only at the White House, but up and down the ballot. So I hold that view quite strongly. On the other hand, I do want to say this. I do believe in an open process. We went through a very closed process last time where party insiders had a tremendous amount of influence and throughout the process had their fingers on the scale against us. And we were, quite successful regardless. We won 23 contests. We got roughly 45% of the pledged delegates in the Democratic Party process. But I really am a believer in an open process. And I do think that the rank and file should choose the next nominee of the Democratic Party, and that includes democratically aligned independents. And, Bernie Sanders now has name recognition he didn't have before, has popularity he didn't have before. He obviously has a credibility, given what we've seen in elections since then, that he didn't have before. He obviously will have access to a tremendous amount of resources from grassroots donations that we weren't confident he would have before. Despite all of that, I would feel very bad if somehow he were put forward in some process where he was anointed by the insiders and not nominated by the voices of the rank and file of the party. Because, look, ultimately, it is the rank and file of the party, democratically aligned independents, and then other voters who are persuadable who are the ones who are going to be voting in a November election. And so we need to bring people into the process. We need to bring them in early. We need to have them participating, not only in the primary election, but in the, in grassroots activities. And I think we will end up with a much healthier party and a much greater chance of success if, in fact, we let the grassroots of the party decide who the nominee is, whether that's Bernie Sanders or maybe the grassroots pick somebody else. But I think that creates in the long term a much healthier party and a much more successful party. So, well, I agree with you on all your points about Bernie. And I think he would, as I said, he is the candidate most likely to beat Trump. In fact, one of Trump's pollsters was on TV just a couple months ago saying, oh, yeah, Bernie would have beat us in 2016. We knew that. He would have won. We have got to have an open and transparent process, and we cannot perpetuate a system where some group of insiders get to decide who the nominee is, whether they guess right or wrong. We can't leave ourselves in the hands of such a small group of people.
Well, I agree with you about that, but don't you see a danger in a small, like when I asked Senator Markey, he was like, oh, there were so many people, and if we kind of tick off several boxes and this person is the right gender, this person is the right color, they're paired with someone else who's from the right state, we can kind of, and this is what's been operating on the local level in some races and in some constituencies like Westchester County, which I mentioned. There's a sense in the Democratic Party that with an infusion of cash and the right marketing and the right advertising and the right internal deciders, and the right donor support, of course, which accompanies all of that, that we can do a top-down imposition of a marketable candidate from out of the blue rather than someone arising from the grassroots. I mean, what is to prevent that from happening yet again with the same disastrous consequences?
Well, I think one of the things that has changed is that there is an incredible awareness now and acceptance no one can deny what happened last time in terms of the process being not a fair and open process. And I think that rank and file Democrats and democratically aligned independents are going to be incredibly sensitive to any sense that the process is being monkeyed with. And I think that will be a great benefit in 2020 so that there is a fair hearing. My view is, and I think the polling bears this out, I think the election returns we've seen since 2016 have all borne it out that the party and frankly in polling and voting in 2016 primaries and caucuses, that the grassroots of the party is much more progressive than the establishment party and much more progressive than many in the establishment understood when we started the 2016 election cycle. And I think there were a number of people, including inside the Clinton campaign, who were caught completely off guard by the fact that the party had moved, shifted substantially from past elections. And, you know, but that's where we are. And if we have this open process, it will, I think, validate that even further, because I think the rank and file voters of the Democratic Party are going to want a bold, progressive leader, and that's who they're going to pick.
How Bernie Won, where you've been speaking with Jeff Weaver, 216 campaign manager for Bernie Sanders and the author of a new book called How Bernie Won. Please share it with your friends. Thank you so much, Jeff, for being with us on Connect the Dots.
My pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Allison Rose Levy. Get How Bernie Won. Sound.